Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads The Secret Garden, Frances Hodgson Burnett's heartwarming story of young orphan Mary Lennox that celebrates the power of nature, friendship, and the human spirit. This is the latest title in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads. If this is your first time with us, you can find all the other novels plus new episodes at classicalfm.ca or through your favorite podcast app. Now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads The Secret Garden.
Chapter 17. A Tantrum. She had got up very early in the morning and had worked hard in the garden, and she was tired and sleepy. So as soon as Martha had brought her supper and she had eaten it, she was glad to go to bed. And as she laid her head on the pillow, she murmured to herself, "I'll go out before breakfast and work with Dickon. And then afterward, I believe, I'll go to see him." She thought it was the middle of the night when she was awakened by such dreadful sounds that she jumped out of bed in an instant. What was it? What was it? The next minute she felt quite sure she knew. Doors were opened and shut, and there were hurrying feet in the corridors, and someone was crying and screaming at the same time, screaming and crying in a horrible way. "It's Colin," she said. "He's having one of those tantrums the nurse called hysterics. How awful it sounds!" As she listened to the sobbing screams, she did not wonder that people were so frightened that they gave him his own way and everything rather than hear them. She put her hands over her ears and felt sick and shivering. "I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Oh, I can't bear it." Once she wondered if he would stop, if she dared go to him, and then she remembered how he had driven her out of the room, and thought that perhaps the sight of her might make him even worse. Even when she pressed her hands more tightly over her ears, she could not keep the awful sounds out. She hated them so, and was so terrified by them, that suddenly they began to make her angry, and she felt as if she should like to fly into a tantrum herself and frighten him as he was frightening her. She was not used to anyone's tempers but her own. She took her hands from her ears and sprang up and stamped her foot. "He ought to be stopped. Somebody ought to make him stop. Somebody ought to beat him," she cried out. Just then she heard feet almost running down the corridor, and her door opened and the nurse came in. She was not laughing now, by any means. She even looked rather pale. "He's worked himself into hysterics," she said in a great hurry. "He'll do himself harm. No one can do anything with him. You, come and try. Come and try like a good child. He likes you." "He turned me out of the room this morning," said Mary, stamping her foot with excitement. The stamp rather pleased the nurse. The truth was that she had been afraid she might find Mary crying and hiding her head under the bedclothes. "That's right," she said. "You're in the right humor. You go and scold him. Give him something new to think of. Do go, child, as quick as ever you can." It was not until afterward that Mary realized that the thing had been funny as well as dreadful. That it was funny that all the grown-up people were so frightened that it came to a little girl just because they guessed she was almost as bad as Colin himself. She flew along the corridor, and the nearer she got to the screams, the higher her temper mounted. She felt quite wicked by the time she reached the door. She slapped it open with her hand and ran across the room to the four-posted bed. "You stop!" she almost shouted. "You stop! I hate you! Everybody hates you. I wish everybody would run out of the house and let you scream yourself to death. You will scream yourself to death in a minute, and I wish you would." A nice, sympathetic child could neither have thought nor said such things, but it just happened that the shock of hearing them was the best possible thing for this hysterical boy whom no one had ever dared to restrain or contradict. He had been lying on his face, beating his pillow with his hands, and he actually almost jumped around. He turned so quickly at the sound of the furious little voice. His face looked dreadful, white and red and swollen, and he was gasping and choking, but savage little Mary did not care an atom. "If you scream another scream," she said, "I'll scream too, and I can scream louder than you can, and I'll frighten you. I'll frighten you." He actually had stopped screaming because she had startled him so. The scream which had been coming almost choked him. The tears were streaming down his face, and he shook all over. "I can't stop," he gasped and sobbed. "I can't. I can't." "You can," shouted Mary. "Half that ails you is hysterics and temper. Just hysterics. Hysterics. Hysterics." And she stamped each time she said it. "I felt the lump. I felt it," choked out Colin. "I knew I should. I shall have a hunch on my back, and then I shall die." And he began to writhe again, and turned on his face, and sobbed and wailed. But he didn't scream. "You didn't feel a lump," contradicted Mary fiercely. "If you did, it was only a hysterical lump. Hysterics make lumps. There's nothing the matter with your horrid back. Nothing but hysterics. Turn over and let me look at it." She liked the word hysterics, and felt somehow as if it had had an effect on him. He was probably like herself, and had never heard it before. "Nurse," she commanded, "come here and show me his back this minute." The nurse, Mrs. Medlock, and Martha had been standing huddled together near the door, staring at her, their mouths half open. All three had gasped with fright more than once. The nurse came forward as if she were half afraid. Colin was heaving with great, breathless sobs. Perhaps he won't let me," she hesitated in a low voice. Colin heard her, however, and he gasped out between two sobs,
Show her! She'll see them!"
It was a poor, thin back to look at when it was bared. Every rib could be counted, and every joint of the spine, though Mistress Mary did not count them as she bent over and examined them with a solemn, savage little face. She looked so sour and old-fashioned that the nurse turned her head aside to hide the twitching of her mouth. There was just a minute's silence, for even Colin tried to hold his breath while Mary looked up and down his spine, and down and up, as intently as if she had been the great doctor from London.
"There's not a single lump there," she said at last. "There's not a lump as big as a pin, except backbone lumps, and you can only feel them because you're thin. I've got backbone lumps myself, and they used to stick out as much as yours do, until I began to get fatter, and I am not fat enough yet to hide them. There's not a lump as big as a pin. If you ever say there is again, I shall laugh."
No one but Colin himself knew what effect these crossly spoken childish words had on him. If he had ever had anyone to talk to about his secret terrors, if he had ever dared to let himself ask questions, if he had had childish companions and had not lain on his back in the huge closed house, breathing an atmosphere heavy with the fears of people who were most of them ignorant and tired of him, he would have found out that most of his fright and illness was created by himself. But he had lain and thought of himself and his aches and weariness for hours and days and months and years. And now that an angry, unsympathetic little girl insisted obstinately that he was not as ill as he thought he was, he actually felt as if she might be speaking the truth.
"I didn't know," ventured the nurse, "that he thought he had a lump on his spine. His back is weak because he won't try to sit up. I could have told him there was no lump there."
Colin gulped and turned his face a little to look at her.
Could you?
He said pathetically.
"Yes, sir." "There," said Mary,
and she gulped too. Colin turned on his face again, and but for his long-drawn, broken breaths, which were the dying down of his storm of sobbing, he lay still for a minute, though great tears streamed down his face and wet the pillow. Actually, the tears meant that a curious, great relief had come to him. Presently he turned and looked at the nurse again, and strangely enough, he was not like a Roger at all as he spoke to her.
Do you think I could live to grow up?" he said.
The nurse was neither clever nor soft-hearted, but she could repeat some of the London doctor's words.
"You probably will if you will do what you are told to do, and not give way to your temper, and stay out a great deal in the fresh air."
Colin's tantrum had passed, and he was weak and worn out with crying, and this perhaps made him feel gentle. He put out his hand a little toward Mary, and I am glad to say that, her own tantrum having passed, she was softened too, and met him halfway with her hand, so that it was a sort of making up.
I'll go out with you, Mary, he said. I shan't hate fresh air if we can find...
He remembered just in time to stop himself from saying, if we can find the secret garden, and he ended,
I shall like to go out with you if Dickon will come and push my chair. I do so want to see Dickon and the fox and the crow.
The nurse remade the tumbled bed and shook and straightened the pillows. Then she made Colin a cup of beef tea and gave a cup to Mary, who really was very glad to get it after her excitement. Mrs. Medlock and Martha gladly slipped away, and after everything was neat and calm and in order, the nurse looked as if she would very gladly slip away also. She was a healthy young woman who resented being robbed of her sleep, and she yawned quite openly as she looked at Mary, who had pushed her big footstool close to the four-posted bed and was holding Colin's hand. "You must go back and get your sleep out," she said. "He'll drop off after a while, if he's not too upset. Then I'll lie down myself in the next room."
"Would you like me to sing you that song I learned from my Aya?" Mary whispered to Colin.
His hand pulled hers gently, and he turned his tired eyes on her appealingly.
"Oh, yes," he answered. "It's such a soft song. I shall go to sleep in a minute."
"I will put him to sleep," Mary said to the yawning nurse. "You can go if you like."
"Well," said the nurse, with an attempt at reluctance, "if he doesn't go to sleep in half an hour, you must call me."
"Very well," answered Mary.
The nurse was out of the room in a minute, and as soon as she was gone, Colin pulled Mary's hand again.
"I almost told," he said, "but I stopped myself in time. I won't talk, and I'll go to sleep. But you said you had a whole lot of nice things to tell me. Have you... Do you think you have found out anything at all about the way into the secret garden?"
Mary looked at his poor little tired face and swollen eyes, and her heart relented.
"Yes," she answered, "I think I have, and if you will go to sleep, I will tell you tomorrow."
His hand quite trembled.
"Oh, Mary," he said, "oh, Mary, if I could get into it, I think I should live to grow up. Do you suppose that instead of singing the Aya song, you could just tell me softly, as you did that first day, what you imagine it looked like inside? I am sure it will make me go to sleep."
"Yes," answered Mary. "Shut your eyes."
He closed his eyes and lay quite still, and she held his hand and began to speak very slowly and in a very low voice.
"I think it has been left alone so long that it has grown all into a lovely tangle. I think the roses have climbed and climbed and climbed until they hang from the branches and walls and creep over the ground, almost like a strange grey mist. Some of them have died, but many, many are alive, and when the summer comes, there will be curtains and fountains of roses. I think the ground is full of daffodils and snowdrops and lilies and iris working their way out of the dark. Now the spring has begun. Perhaps,
the soft drone of her voice was making him stiller and stiller, and she saw it and went on.
Perhaps they are coming up through the grass. Perhaps there are clusters of purple crocuses and gold ones even now. Perhaps the leaves are beginning to break out and incurl, and perhaps the grey is changing, and a green gauze veil is creeping and creeping over everything. And the birds are coming to look at it, because it is so safe and so still. And perhaps,
very softly and slowly indeed,
The robin has found a mate and is building a nest. And Colin was asleep.
Chapter 18. The Munnet Wastes No Time. Of course, Mary did not waken early the next morning. She slept late because she was tired, and when Martha brought her breakfast, she told her that though Colin was quite quiet, he was ill and feverish, as he always was after he had worn himself out with a fit of crying. Mary ate her breakfast slowly as she listened.
"He says thou would please go and see him as soon as thou can," Martha said. "It's clear what a fancy he's took to thee. Thou did give it to him last night for sure, didn't thou? Nobody else would have dared to do it. Oh, poor lad, he's been spoiled till salt won't save him. Mother says as the two worst things that can happen to a child is never to have his own way, or always to have it. She doesn't know which is the worst. Thou was in a fine temper thyself, too. But he says to me when I went into his room, 'Please ask Miss Mary if she'll please come and talk to me.' Think I'm saying please. Will you go, miss?"
"I'll run and see Dickon first," said Mary. "No, I'll go and see Colin first and tell him. I know what I'll tell him," with a sudden inspiration.
She had her hat on when she appeared in Colin's room, and for a second he looked disappointed. He was in bed. His face was pitifully white, and there were dark circles round his eyes.
"I'm glad you came," he said. "My head aches, and I ache all over because I'm so tired. Are you going somewhere?"
Mary went and leaned against his bed.
"I won't be long," she said. "I'm going to Dickon, but I'll come back. Colin, it's something about the garden."
His whole face brightened, and a little colour came into it.
"Oh, is it?" he cried out. "I dreamed about it all night. I heard you say something about grey changing into green, and I dreamed I was standing in a place all filled with trembling little green leaves, and there were birds on nests everywhere, and they looked so soft and still. I'll lie and think about it until you come back."
In 5 minutes, Mary was with Dickon in their garden. The fox and the crow were with them again, and this time he had brought two tame squirrels.
"I came over on the pony this morning," he said. "Eh, he is a good little chap, Jump is. I brought these two in my pockets. This here one's he's called Nut, and this here other one's called Shell."
When he said Nut, one squirrel leapt onto his right shoulder, and when he said Shell, the other one leapt onto his left shoulder. When they sat down on the grass with Captain curled at their feet, Soot solemnly listening on a tree, and Nut and Chill nosing about close to them, it seemed to Mary that it would be scarcely bearable to leave such delightfulness. But when she began to tell her story, somehow the look in Dickon's funny face gradually changed her mind. She could see he felt sorrier for Colin than she did. He looked up at the sky and all about him.
"Just listen to them birds. The world seems full of them, all whistling and piping," he said. "Look at them tartin' about, and hearken at them callin' to each other. Come springtime, seems like as if all the world's callin'. The leaves is uncurlin' so you can see 'em, and, my word, the nice smells there is about,"
sniffing with his happy turned-up nose.
"And that poor lad lying shut up and seeing so little that he gets to thinking of things that sets him screaming. Oh, my! Women get him out here. Women get him watching and listening and sniffing up the air and get him just soaked through with sunshine, and we mayn't lose no time about it."
When he was very much interested, he often spoke quite broad Yorkshire, though at other times he tried to modify his dialect so that Mary could better understand. But she loved his broad Yorkshire, and had in fact been trying to learn to speak it herself. So she spoke a little now.
"Aye, that me man," she said, which meant, "Yes, indeed, we must. I'll tell thee what us'll do first," she proceeded,
and Dickon grinned, because when the little wench tried to twist her tongue into speaking Yorkshire, it amused him very much.
"He's took a greatly fancy to thee. He wants to see thee, and he wants to see Soot and Captain. When I go back to the house to talk to him, I'll ax him if thou canna come and see him tomorrow morning, and bring the creatures with thee. And then,
in a bit, when there's more leaves out, and happen a bud or two, we'll get him to come out, and I shall push him in his chair, and we'll bring him here and show him everything."
When she stopped, she was quite proud of herself. She had never made a long speech in Yorkshire before, and she had remembered very well.
"The mun talk a bit of Yorkshire like that to Mr. Colin," Dickon chuckled. "They'll make him laugh, and there's not as good for ill folk as laughing is. Mother says she believes as half an hour's good laugh every morning a'd cure a chap as was making ready for typhus fever." "I'm going to talk Yorkshire to him this very day," said Mary, chuckling herself.
The garden had reached the time when every day and every night it seemed as if magicians were passing through it, drawing loveliness out of the earth and the boughs with wands. It was hard to go away and leave it all, particularly as Nut had actually crept onto her dress, and Shell had scrambled down the trunk of the apple tree they sat under and stayed there looking at her with inquiring eyes. But she went back to the house, and when she sat down close to Colin's bed, he began to sniff as Dickon did, though not in such an experienced way.
"You smell like flowers and fresh things," he cried out quite joyously. "What is it you smell of? It's cool and warm and sweet all at the same time." "It's the wind from the moor," said Mary. "It comes a sitting on the grass under a tree with Dickon and with Captain and Soot and Nut and Shell. It's the springtime and out of doors and sunshine as smells so greatly."
She said it as broadly as she could, and you do not know how broadly Yorkshire sounds until you have heard someone speak it. Colin began to laugh.
"What are you doing?" he said. "I never heard you talk like that before. How funny it sounds." "I'm giving thee a bit of Yorkshire," answered Mary triumphantly. "I cannot talk as greatly as Dickon and Martha can, but thou sees I can shape a bit. Doesn't thou understand a bit of Yorkshire when thou hears it? And thou's a Yorkshire lad thyself, bred and born. Eh, I wonder thou'rt not ashamed of thy face."
And then she began to laugh too. And they both laughed until they could not stop themselves, and they laughed until the room echoed, and Mrs. Medlock, opening the door to come in, drew back into the corridor and stood listening, amazed.
"Well, upon my word," she said,
speaking rather broad Yorkshire herself, because there was no one to hear her, and she was so astonished.
"Who ever heard the like? Who ever on earth would have thought it?"
There was so much to talk about. It seemed as if Colin could never hear enough of Dickon and Captain and Soot and Nut and Shell and the pony, whose name was Jump. Mary had run round into the wood with Dickon to see Jump. He was a tiny little shaggy moor pony, with thick locks hanging over his eyes, and with a pretty face and a nuzzling velvet nose. He was rather thin with living on moor grass, but he was as tough and wiry as if the muscle in his little legs had been made of steel springs. He had lifted his head and whinnied softly the moment he saw Dickon, and he had trotted up to him and put his head across his shoulder. And then Dickon had talked into his ear, and Jump had talked back in odd little whinnies and puffs and snorts. Dickon had made him give Mary his small front hoof and kiss her on her cheek with his velvet muzzle.
"Does he really understand everything Dickon says?" Colin asked. "It seems as if he does," answered Mary. "Dickon says anything will understand if you're friends with it, for sure. But you have to be friends for sure."
Colin lay quiet a little while, and his strange grey eyes seemed to be staring at the wall. But Mary saw he was thinking.
"I wish I was friends with things," he said at last.
"But I'm not. I never had anything to be friends with, and I can't bear people."
"Can't you bear me?"
asked Mary.
"Yes, I can," he answered. "It's funny, but I even like you." "Ben Weatherstaff said I was like him," said Mary. "He said he'd warrant we'd both got the same nasty tempers. I think you are like him, too. We are all three alike, you and I and Ben Weatherstaff. He said we were neither of us much to look at, and we were as sour as we looked. But I don't feel as sour as I used to before I knew the robin and Dickon. Did you feel as if you hated people?"
"Yes," answered Mary, without any affectation.
"I should have detested you if I had seen you before I saw the robin and Dickon." Colin put out his thin hand and touched her. "Mary," he said, "I wish I hadn't said what I did about sending Dickon away. I hated you when you said he was like an angel, and I laughed at you. But perhaps he is." "Well, it was rather funny to say it," she admitted frankly, "because his nose does turn up, and he has a big mouth, and his clothes have patches all over them, and he talks broad Yorkshire. But if an angel did come to Yorkshire and live on the moor, if there was a Yorkshire angel, I believe he'd understand the green things and know how to make them grow, and he would know how to talk to the wild creatures as Dickon does, and they'd know he was friends for sure." "I shouldn't mind Dickon looking at me," said Colin. "I want to see him." "Oh, I'm glad you said that," answered Mary, because... Quite suddenly, it came into her mind that this was the minute to tell him. Colin knew something new was coming. "Because what?" he cried eagerly. Mary was so anxious that she got up from her stool and came to him and caught hold of both his hands. "Can I trust you? I trusted Dickon because birds trusted him. Can I trust you? For sure. For sure," she implored. Her face was so solemn that he almost whispered his answer. "Yes. Yes. Well, Dickon will come to see you tomorrow morning, and he'll bring his creatures with him." "Oh!" Colin cried out in delight. "But that's not all," Mary went on, almost pale with solemn excitement. "The rest is better. There is a door into the garden. I found it. It is under the ivy on the wall." If he had been a strong, healthy boy, Colin would probably have shouted, "Hooray! Hooray! Hooray!" But he was weak and rather hysterical. His eyes grew bigger and bigger, and he gasped for breath. "Oh, Mary," he cried out with a half sob, "shall I see it? Shall I get into it? Shall I live to get into it?" And he clutched her hands and dragged her toward him. "Of course you'll see it," snapped Mary indignantly. "Of course you'll live to get into it. Don't be silly." And she was so unhysterical and natural and childish that she brought him to his senses, and he began to laugh at himself. And a few minutes afterwards, she was sitting on her stool again, telling him not what she imagined the secret garden to be like, but what it really was. And Colin's aches and tiredness were forgotten, and he was listening enraptured.
"It is just what you thought it would be," he said at last. "It sounds just as if you had really seen it. You know I said that when you told me first."
Mary hesitated about 2 minutes, and then boldly spoke the truth.
"I had seen it, and I had been in," she said. "I found the key and got in weeks ago, but I daren't tell you. I daren't tell you because I was so afraid I couldn't trust you for sure."
Chapter 19.
It has come.
Of course, Dr. Craven had been sent for the morning after Colin had had his tantrum. He was always sent for at once when such a thing occurred, and he always found, when he arrived, a white, shaken boy lying on his bed, sulky and still so hysterical that he was ready to break into fresh sobbing at the least word. In fact, Dr. Craven dreaded and detested the difficulties of these visits. On this occasion, he was away from Misselthwaite Manor until afternoon.
"How is he?"
he asked Mrs. Medlock, rather irritably, when he arrived.
"He will break a blood vessel in one of those fits some day. The boy is half insane with hysteria and self-indulgence."
"Well, sir," answered Mrs. Medlock, "you'll scarcely believe your eyes when you see him. That plain, sour-faced child that's almost as bad as himself has just bewitched him. How she's done it, there's no telling. The Lord knows she's nothing to look at, and you scarcely ever hear her speak. But she did what none of us dared do. She just flew at him like a little cat last night, and stamped her feet and ordered him to stop screaming. And somehow she startled him so that he actually did stop. And this afternoon... Well, just come up and see, sir. It's past crediting."
The scene which Dr. Craven beheld when he entered his patient's room was indeed rather astonishing to him. As Mrs. Medlock opened the door,
he heard laughing and chattering. Colin was on his sofa in his dressing gown, and he was sitting up quite straight, looking at a picture in one of the garden books, and talking to the plain child, who at that moment could scarcely be called plain at all, because her face was so glowing with enjoyment.
"Those long spires of blue ones, we'll have a lot of those," Colin was announcing. "They're called delphiniums. Dickens says they're larkspurs made big and grand," cried Mistress Mary. "There are clumps there already."
Then they saw Dr. Craven and stopped. Mary became quite still, and Colin looked fretful.
"I am sorry to hear you were ill last night, my boy," Dr. Craven said, a trifle nervously. He was rather a nervous man.
"I'm better now, much better," Colin answered, rather like a Raja. "I'm going out in my chair in a day or two, if it is fine. I want some fresh air."
Dr. Craven sat down by him and felt his pulse and looked at him curiously.
"It must be a very fine day," he said, "and you must be very careful not to tire yourself."
"Fresh air won't tire me," said the young Raja.
As there had been occasions when this same young gentleman had shrieked aloud with rage and had insisted that fresh air would give him cold and kill him, it is not to be wondered at that his doctor felt somewhat startled.
"I thought you did not like fresh air," he said.
"I don't when I am by myself," replied the Raja, "but my cousin is going out with me."
"And the nurse, of course," suggested Dr. Craven.
"No, I will not have the nurse,"
so magnificently that Mary could not help remembering how the young native prince had looked with his diamonds and emeralds and pearls stuck all over him and the great rubies on the small dark hand he had waved to command his servants to approach with salams and receive his orders.
"My cousin knows how to take care of me. I am always better when she is with me. She made me better last night. A very strong boy, I know, will push my carriage."
Dr. Craven felt rather alarmed. If this tiresome, hysterical boy should chance to get well, he himself would lose all chance of inheriting Misselthwaite. But he was not an unscrupulous man, though he was a weak one, and he did not intend to let him run into actual danger.
"He must be a strong boy and a steady boy," he said, "and I must know something about him. Who is he? What is his name?"
"It's Dickon,"
Mary spoke up suddenly. She felt somehow that everybody who knew the moor must know Dickon. And she was right, too. She saw that in a moment Dr. Craven's serious face relaxed into a relieved smile.
"Oh, Dickon," he said. "If it is Dickon, you will be safe enough. He's as strong as a moor pony, is Dickon."
"And he's trusty," said Mary. "He's the trustiest lad of Yorkshire."
She had been talking Yorkshire to Colin, and she forgot herself.
"Did Dickon teach you that?" asked Dr. Craven, laughing outright.
"I'm learning it as if it was French," said Mary, rather coldly. "It's like a native dialect in India. Very clever people try to learn them. I like it, and so does Colin."
"Well, well," he said, "if it amuses you, perhaps it won't do you any harm. Did you take your bromide last night, Colin?"
"No," Colin answered. "I wouldn't take it at first, and after Mary made me quiet, she talked me to sleep, in a low voice, about the spring creeping into a garden."
"That sounds soothing," said Dr. Craven,
more perplexed than ever, and glancing sideways at Mistress Mary sitting on her stool and looking down silently at the carpet. "You are evidently better, but you must remember—"
"I don't want to remember,"
interrupted the Raja, appearing again.
"When I lie by myself and remember, I begin to have pains everywhere, and I think of things that make me begin to scream because I hate them so. If there was a doctor anywhere who could make you forget you were ill instead of remembering it, I would have him brought here."
And he waved a thin hand, which ought really to have been covered with royal signet rings made of rubies.
"It is because my cousin makes me forget that she makes me better."
Dr. Craven had never made such a short stay after a tantrum. Usually he was obliged to remain a very long time and do a great many things. This afternoon he did not give any medicine or leave any new orders, and he was spared any disagreeable scenes. When he went downstairs, he looked very thoughtful, and when he talked to Mrs. Medlock in the library, she felt that he was a much puzzled man.
"Well, sir," she ventured, "could you have believed it?"
"It certainly is a new state of affairs," said the doctor, "and there's no denying it is better than the old one."
"I believe Susan Sowerby's right. I do that," said Mrs. Medlock. "I stopped in her cottage on my way to Thwaite yesterday and had a bit of a talk with her, and she says to me, 'Well, Sarah Ann, she mayn't be a good child and she mayn't be a pretty one, but she's a child, and children needs children.' We went to school together, Susan Sowerby and me."
"She's the best sick nurse I know," said Dr. Craven. "When I find her in a cottage, I know the chances are that I shall save my patient."
Mrs. Medlock smiled. She was fond of Susan Sowerby. "She's got a way with her, has Susan," she went on quite volubly. "I've been thinking all morning of one thing she said yesterday. She says, 'Once when I was giving the children a bit of a preach after they'd been fighting, I says to 'em all, when I was at school, my geography told as the world was shaped like a orange, and I found out before I was 10 that the whole orange doesn't belong to nobody. No one owns more than his bit of a quarter, and there's times it seems like there's not enough quarters to go round. But don't you, none of you, think as you own the whole orange, or you'll find out that you're mistaken, and you won't find it out without hard knocks. What children learns from children,' she says, 'is that there's no sense in grabbing at the whole orange, peel and all. If you do, you'll likely not get even the pips, and them's too bitter to eat.'" "She's a shrewd woman," said Dr. Craven, putting on his coat.
"Well, she's got a way of saying things," ended Mrs. Medlock, much pleased. "Sometimes I've said to her, 'Eh, Susan, if you was a different woman and didn't talk such broad Yorkshire, I've seen the times when I should have said you was clever.'"
That night, Colin slept without once awakening, and when he opened his eyes in the morning, he lay still and smiled without knowing it, smiled because he felt so curiously comfortable. It was actually nice to be awake, and he turned over and stretched his limbs luxuriously. He felt as if tight strings which had held him had loosened themselves and let him go. He did not know that Dr. Craven would have said that his nerves had relaxed and rested themselves. Instead of lying and staring at the wall and wishing he had not awakened, his mind was full of the plans he and Mary had made yesterday, of pictures of the garden, and of Dickon and his wild creatures. It was so nice to have things to think about, and he had not been awake more than 10 minutes when he heard feet running along the corridor, and Mary was at the door. The next minute she was in the room and had run across to his bed, bringing with her a waft of fresh air full of the scent of the morning.
"You've been out! You've been out! There's that nice smell of leaves!" he cried.
She had been running, and her hair was loose and blown, and she was bright with the air and pink-cheeked, though he could not see it.
"It's so beautiful," she said, a little breathless with her speed. "You never saw anything so beautiful. It has come. I thought it had come that other morning, but it was only coming. It is here now. It has come, the spring. Dickon says so."
"Has it?" cried Colin, and though he really knew nothing about it, he felt his heart beat. He actually sat up in bed.
"Open the window,"
he added, laughing half with joyful excitement and half at his own fancy.
"Perhaps we may hear golden trumpets."
And though he laughed, Mary was at the window in a moment, and in a moment more it was opened wide, and freshness and softness and scents and bird songs were pouring through.
"That's fresh air," she said. "Lie on your back and draw in long breaths of it. That's what Dickon does when he's lying on the moor. He says he feels it in his veins and it makes him strong, and he feels as if he could live forever and ever. Breathe it and breathe it."
She was only repeating what Dickon had told her, but she caught Colin's fancy.
"Forever and ever. Does it make him feel like that?"
he said. And he did as she told him, drawing in long, deep
breaths over and over again, until he felt that something quite new and delightful was happening to him. Mary was at his bedside again. "Things are crowding up out of the earth," she ran on in a hurry, "and there are flowers uncurling, and buds on everything, and the green veil has covered nearly all the grey, and the birds are in such a hurry about their nests for fear they may be too late that some of them are even fighting for places in the secret garden. Oh, and the rose bushes look as wick can be, and there are primroses in the lanes and woods, and the seeds we planted are up, and Dickon has brought the fox and the crow and the squirrels and a new-born lamb." And then she paused for breath. The newborn lamb Dickon had found 3 days before lying by its dead mother among the gorse bushes on the moor. It was not the first motherless lamb he had found, and he knew what to do with it. He had taken it to the cottage wrapped in his jacket, and he had let it lie near the fire, and had fed it with warm milk. It was a soft thing, with a darling, silly baby face and legs rather long for its body. Dickon had carried it over the moor in his arms, and its feeding bottle was in his pocket with a squirrel, and when Mary had sat under a tree with its limp warmness huddled on her lap, she had felt as if she were too full of strange joy to speak. A lamb! A lamb! A living lamb who lay on your lap like a baby! She was describing it with great joy, and Colin was listening and drawing in long breaths of air when the nurse entered. She started a little at the sight of the open window. She had sat stifling in the room many a warm day because her patient was sure that open windows gave people cold.
"Are you sure you're not chilly, Master Colin?"
she inquired. "No," was the answer. "I am breathing long breaths of fresh air. It makes you strong. I am going to get up to the sofa for breakfast. My cousin will have breakfast with me." The nurse went away, concealing a smile, to give the order for two breakfasts. She found the servants' hall a more amusing place than the invalid's chamber, and just now everybody wanted to hear the news from upstairs. There was a great deal of joking about the unpopular young recluse, who, as the cook said, had found his master and good for him. The servants' hall had been very tired of the tantrums, and the butler, who was a man with a family, had more than once expressed his opinion that the invalid would be all the better for a good hiding. When Colin was on his sofa, and the breakfast for two was put upon the table, he made an announcement to the nurse in his most Rajah-like manner.
"A boy and a fox and a crow and two squirrels and a newborn lamb are coming to see me this morning. I want them brought upstairs as soon as they come,"
he said.
"You are not to begin playing with the animals in the servants' hall and keep them there. I want them here."
The nurse gave a slight gasp and tried to conceal it with a cough.
"Yes, sir," she answered.
"I'll tell you what you can do,"
added Colin, waving his hand.
"You can tell Martha to bring them here. The boy is Martha's brother. His name is Dickon, and he is an animal charmer."
"I hope the animals won't bite, Master Colin," said the nurse.
"I told you he was a charmer," said Colin austerely. "Charmers' animals never bite."
"There are snake charmers in India," said Mary, "and they can put their snakes' heads in their mouths."
"Goodness!" shuddered the nurse.
They ate their breakfast with the morning air pouring in upon them. Colin's breakfast was a very good one, and Mary watched him with serious intent.
"You will begin to get fatter just as I did," she said. "I never wanted my breakfast when I was in India, and now I always want it." "I wanted mine this morning," said Colin. "Perhaps it was the fresh air. When do you think Dickon will come?"
He was not long in coming. In about 10 minutes, Mary held up her hand.
"Listen," she said. "Did you hear a caw?"
Colin listened and heard it. The oddest sound in the world to hear inside a house. A hoarse caw, caw.
"Yes," he answered. "That's soot," said Mary. "Listen again. Do you hear a bleat? A tiny one?" "Oh, yes," cried Colin, quite flushing. "That's the newborn lamb," said Mary. "He's coming."
Dickon's moorland boots were thick and clumsy, and though he tried to walk quietly, they made a clumping sound as he walked through the long corridors.
Marian Colin heard him marching, marching, until he passed through the tapestry door onto the soft carpet of Colin's own passage.
"If you please, sir,"
announced Martha, opening the door.
"If you please, sir, here's Dickon and his creatures."
Dickon came in smiling his nicest wide smile. The newborn lamb was in his arms, and the little red fox trotted by his side. Nut sat on his left shoulder, and Soot on his right, and Shell's head and paws peeped out of his coat pocket. Colin slowly sat up and stared, as he had stared when he first saw Mary. But this was a stare of wonder and delight. The truth was that in spite of all he had heard, he had not in the least understood what this boy would be like, and that his fox and his crow and his squirrels and his lamb were so near to him and his friendliness that they seemed almost to be part of himself. Colin had never talked to a boy in his life, and he was so overwhelmed by his own pleasure and curiosity that he did not even think of speaking. But Dickon did not feel the least shy or awkward. He had not felt embarrassed because the crow had not known his language and had only stared and had not spoken to him the first time they met. Creatures were always like that until they found out about you. He walked over to Colin's sofa and put the newborn lamb quietly on his lap. And immediately the little creature turned to the warm velvet dressing gown and began to nuzzle and nuzzle into its folds and butt its tight curled head with soft impatience against his side. Of course, no boy could have helped speaking then.
"What is it doing?" cried Colin. "What does it want?"
"It wants its mother," said Dickon, smiling more and more. "I brought it to thee a bit hungry because I knowed thou'd like to see it feed."
He knelt down by the sofa and took a feeding bottle from his pocket.
"Come on, little un,"
he said, turning the small woolly white head with a gentle brown hand.
"This is what thou's after. Thou'll get more of this now than thou wilt out of sick velvet coats. There now."
And he pushed the rubber tip of the bottle into the nuzzling mouth, and the lamb began to suck it with ravenous ecstasy. After that, there was no wondering what to say. By the time the lamb fell asleep, questions poured forth, and Dickon answered them all. He told them how he had found the lamb just as the sun was rising 3 mornings ago. He had been standing on the moor, listening to a skylark, and watching him swing higher and higher into the sky until he was only a speck in the heights of blue.
"I'd almost lost him but for his song, and I was wondering how a chap could hear it when it seemed as if he'd get out of the world in a minute. And just then I heard something else far off among the gorse bushes. It was a weak bleating, and I knowed it was a new lamb as was hungry, and I knowed it wouldn't be hungry if it hadn't lost its mother somehow. So I set off searching. I did have a look for it. I went in and out among the gorse bushes and round and round, and I always seemed to take the wrong turning. But at last I seed a bit of white by a rock on top of the moor, and I climbed up and found the little un half dead with cold and clemming."
While he talked, Soot flew solemnly in and out of the open window and cawed remarks about the scenery, while Nut and Shell made excursions into the big trees outside and ran up and down trunks and explored branches. Captain curled up near Dickon, who sat on the hearthrug from preference. They looked at the pictures in the gardening books, and Dickon knew all the flowers by their country names, and knew exactly which ones were already growing in the secret garden.
"I couldn't say that their name," he said, pointing to one under which was written Aquilegia. "But us calls that a columbine, and that there one, it's a snapdragon. And they both grow wild in hedges, but these is garden ones, and they're bigger and grander. There's some big clumps of columbine in the garden. They'll look like a bed of blue and white butterflies fluttering when they're out."
"I'm going to see them," cried Colin. "I'm going to see them."
"Aye, that's the mun," said Mary, quite seriously. "And the munnet lose no time about it."
Thanks for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads The Secret Garden, This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. This is the latest book in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Anne of Green Gables, Vanity Fair, and Showboat are just a few of the other novels in the series. You can find them all at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get podcasts. You can also help support this podcast by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review in your preferred podcast store. And while you're there, look for a variety of other quality podcasts proudly presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network.